Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we've got a very special program. We're going to be talking about sort of research in the general sense. You're used to listening to astronauts or assistant professors of microbiology or people who study archaeology in Peru or wherever. Well, today we're going to be talking to two people about the nature of research, and we're going to start with the provost of the University of Texas at El Paso, who trained as a scientist and is now in charge of the academic affairs of the university, and his name is Junius Gonzalez. And Junius, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much, Keith. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to chatting a little bit about research, science, and more.
Jolly good. Well, before we get into the topic, though, I'd like the audience to know a little bit about Junius. Where'd you come from? How did you become a scientist? And how did you become a provost?
Well, my path was neither planful nor direct for either science or being a provost. I am the first child of a family, immigrant family, to go to college. And I ended up going to medical school, but that was not planned. It frankly was serendipitous because it was easier to get into medical school than other doctoral programs at the time when I was in college. So,
when was that? I mean,
1980.
I know, but I mean, I've never heard that as an expression of reality.
My college had, I was very interested in clinical psychology, and my college happened to have a, I don't know, 98% acceptance rate to medical school. So this seemed to me to be a slightly better and easier option, frankly.
Okay.
I joke a little bit about it because in medical school, I then had some research experiences that were extensions of some work I did in college. And I was always fascinated in human behavior. And then as my career evolved, I trained in internal medicine and psychiatry. I was very much interested in, could research and science make a meaningful impact in the day-to-day lives of people today, tomorrow, or over the next few years, and not 10, 20, 30 years out. So my path, again, was not circuitous. I took time off after college. I took time off to do a research fellowship funded by the Dana Foundation and trained in what's called health services research now, which is a truly interdisciplinary mix for applied research, everything from how patients, let's say, value their health care and their health to systems-level issues of managed care and the economic costs of health care and so forth. To be very quick, I started in a traditional academic root at Georgetown as a psychiatrist and researcher, was funded by NIH on several projects related, again, to the real-world concerns of people who had mental health and chronic physical diseases. And then I was asked to return to the National Institutes of Health for a national administrative role very early in my career, and I did it because the new head of the National Institute of Mental Health was my former teacher and individual supervisor.
Ah, cronyism.
Yes, yes.
And that's always an important feature in career development. They call it networking. It's another terminology. But it's interesting, though, that you had, right from the beginning, some idea that research should have a sort of a dramatic and quick impact on society. And, you know, coming from the medical sort of side of things, I suppose that's relatively clear. But if you're, for example, someone like myself who's interested in the chemistry of tin, right, it's not quite so easy to see that sort of direct correlation. And so I think one has to beware a little of always thinking there has to be a rapid sort of impact in the real world, as you put it.
I agree. There is not necessarily about the rapidity of impact, but I do think that scientific inquiry should have, whether it's long-term, impact on the world, on society, as opposed to, and this is my personal bias, just simply contributing to a knowledge base that then can't be harvested for good, and it may be 50 years down the line.
Okay, so I mean that's the big sort of let out. That's the big gap in the logic that you don't quite. You're never going to predict when whatever anything happens in a laboratory in terms of science research now is going to have any impact. And frankly, you cannot just go on the assumption, I'm saying this is Keith's sort of opinion, of doing research with that goal always at the end of a particular rationale, a particular outcome. You've got to advance on lots of different levels, and not all of them are going to impact mankind, except that in university we train people. And so that's always our sort of ticket to being able to get extra funding, if you like, that we're not just doing research, but there's another impact on education and the production of scientists who then themselves could go out and tackle specific problems.
That's right. And that that piece and that linkage to education and, frankly, the highest quality and rigorous training possible is critical, because the sort of methodologies and the rigor of thinking and the discipline required to do the highest quality research, which one would think is linked to eventual impact, either to answering a question in the current knowledge base or having a view that this might somehow make a contribution, you know, 30 or 40 years down the line to some new composition of material that may be useful in the world, is certainly critical.
Let's go from there then. You're now a provost. Just define for the audience, because I'm sure most people don't know, what on earth is a provost, and how is it that you came from the background that you just said into being a provost?
So the historical roots of provost are jailer, which sometimes I do feel is appropriate in my role, the keeping of certain things. But it is a very exciting role these days, particularly in public higher education, and exceptionally challenging. The provost is the chief academic officer and here responsible for all academic programs, curriculum, new innovations in teaching and learning, as well as trying to drive research and scholarship for faculty and for students, and also here student affairs and things like community engagement also report to the provost. My background was circuitous. I went to the National Institutes of Health, where I held research administrative roles, then took a detour and went back to school in my mid-40s, then went to a private for-profit consulting firm and worked on science.
So you brought a dowry with you, right?
That's right. I wish. I wish. It was the kind of place where you learn what it means to have 50% of your time be billable hours. But very useful, because I had wonderful experiences in landing some very interesting work in science and technology. I traveled all over the world for certain projects and actually extended beyond only health research. And then from there, I was recruited to the University of South Florida to be the dean of a large behavioral research and training institute, which was sort of up my alley. And then 10 months into that, was asked to create a brand new college with traditional academic units and programs, and had a good time, although somewhat stressful time doing that.
But that's actually quite a sort of a large resume, in fact, many different things. And one of the points you brought up, and we won't discuss it much, but it is an issue that people don't realize until they're in a university environment, is just how much the outreach portion of this job is important. And a lot of us who do academics, we're not so good at the outreach, right? We just, oh, you've got to do that again. And that's a very difficult part, I think, of the job.
It is. But I do enjoy some of the outreach, particularly with certain constituents, whether it's to funding agencies or other experts. One of the things in my role that I'm committed to here at UTEP, as you know, is faculty development and enhancement, and providing, despite our challenging resource-constrained times, providing new opportunities for faculty to develop their research careers, working very closely with the deans to ensure that if departments or colleges don't have the in-house expertise for certain things, that we need to get that for, in particular, our junior faculty. One of the most exciting things recently here, as you think about science and scholarly and creative activity that's at the highest level, is we released a request for proposals for the arts and humanities here to support, with fairly large awards, faculty at UTEP who wrote proposals. We just finished that process, and we were absolutely delighted but also dismayed by the very large number of extremely high-quality proposals because we only had a certain amount of funding. But what we're trying to do is support the faculty and inspire them, for example, to plan out their trajectory. A little bit is selfish on my part in that I would like UTEP, for example, to win some international awards that it's never won, like a Guggenheim Award. And we know that we have the faculty who can do that.
That's interesting because, I mean, and you've brought it up and it's a nice segue into the next part of the discussion, and that is that when most people think about research, they tend to think about it in terms of science, engineering, biomedicine, and things like that. I happen to be the chair of the University Research Committee this year. And so there's always a tension in that committee, you know, that somebody comes from the music department or wherever with an idea, and there's always a finite number of people who say, well, that's not really research. And I kick against that very strongly. And so it's very nice that you've sort of been able to get another pot of money which specifically addresses the type of activity that goes on, which doesn't always get classified under research, but which is absolutely important.
Yes.
Before we get into that, because that's in the second part of the program, just got a couple of minutes, I'd like you to sort of extemporize on where you see research in universities in terms of working with outside companies and vice versa. There's been a lot of talk in the recent years that American industry is not supporting research very much. And yet now we hear an awful lot of pressure from universities to say, well, collaborate with outside companies, you know, try and get something going here. Intellectual property, that's a word that we hear a lot of. Tell me just briefly where you see the role of the university in that type of research.
I think the role of the university, again, it's a multi-pronged role to support and enhance its faculty, to drive the production of the highest quality knowledge and scientific inquiry, and to involve students in that. I think the opportunities with industry for certain fields are potentially very high payoff at a number of levels. Part of it is the bottom line issue of driving fiscal resources and getting another source of revenue. But imagine being like University of Florida and inventing Gatorade and essentially being able to support, I'll make this number up, 20 faculty a year based simply on the proceeds of that patent. So there is a very practical aspect to it. But I think if one can kill several birds with one stone, so to speak, and think about an integrated, multifunctional role for industry in the university, there's a lot of huge potential there. It is true that some industries like big pharma have cut back on their basic R&D, and the National Institutes of Health has taken up that charge with a new center for translational science. But I think there are key opportunities. I think if, from what I see, the UTEP faculty are very dedicated to the students, are able to integrate student experiences into industry funding, and all the intellectual property issues are worked out, it is another new path to take. Not so new for some people, but I think it does offer lots of opportunities. And I think it offers opportunities in research and science that we don't traditionally think of.
You're listening to Science Studio. We've been talking the first half of the program with Junius Gonzalez. He's the provost, the jailer at the University of Texas at El Paso. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. By the time the 2012 Summer Olympics ended, over 6,000 blood and urine samples were tested to keep the games clean.
Despite this record-setting effort, officials already predict a mightier effort in future games when athletes are tempted by a new type of performance enhancement, gene doping.
No athlete has been caught, although no test exists yet. So far, gene therapy is still in the testing phase to treat people with inherited disorders such as muscular dystrophy. But unscrupulous athletes may risk gene manipulation, hoping for superhuman results.
They may be further tempted by evidence that certain elite athletes naturally possess gene variants that give them an edge. For example, cross-country skier and 7-time Olympic medalist Eero Mantaranta has a gene variant called EPO-R, which produces extra red blood cells, boosting his oxygen-carrying capacity by 25 to 50%.
Scientists have also found that nearly every Olympic sprinter carries a particular form of the ACTN3 gene. Another, the I variant of the ACE gene, is associated with increased endurance and found in elite British long-distance runners.
This raises interesting questions. As gene therapy for medical conditions gains momentum, would someone given the EPO-R gene variant for a blood disorder be ineligible for the Olympics?
We don't think so, because any power gene by itself won't likely improve athletic performance. A combination of genes, extraordinary dedication, and professional training are what create a world-class athlete.
That may be, but given the money and fame that comes with athletic greatness, gene doping is a near certainty.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell here with Junius Gonzalez, the provost of the University of Texas at El Paso. And in this second section, we are introducing a faculty member from the Department of Music, Dr. Dina Jones. She's an outstanding soloist on piano and I'm sure a wonderful teacher. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Dina is a performer. And I remember maybe 7 years ago, I don't remember exactly, I was, again, on this research committee at the university, and a proposal came in from someone I didn't know, Dina Jones, saying that she wanted some money to hire a theater or a concert hall in New York in order to give a solo performance and develop her career by being in New York and making this presentation.
Yes.
And there was a lot of discussion that ensued in that committee meeting in saying, well, this has got nothing to do with research and clearly shouldn't be considered, put on pile B. And I insisted it come to pile A, and in fact, we funded that.
That's right.
Dina, tell us why that is an important part of the sort of development of a music professor and how you see research in that whole program.
Well, at that particular junction in my career, I'd just been hired here and actually already had that recital sort of established. And for musicians, to be an expert in one's field. That concert was highlighting the piano works of Joaquin Rodrigo, who was the composer that I wrote my thesis on. So Keith, so many years had gone already into researching this country, music and culture. I learned the language, applied for a Fulbright scholarship and was denied for probably some of the same reasons that came up in that discussion with that panel that you were on that committee with, that it's, as music perhaps, it's not as vital or important to humanity as some of these other areas. But establishing oneself as an expert in a music field is so important. And to be able to express your research in a venue like New York at Merkin Hall was the name of the place, and to invite people who have an interest in this particular genre and move forward. That was just really, really important as a junior faculty member here. And as Dr. Gonzalez mentioned, UTEP is, with your support too, Keith, you know, has always tried to establish their junior faculty to show, yes, this is what we see with projection with Dr. Jones at that point.
When you say that the, you know, the performance was in sort of the culmination of many years of previous work, and then you mentioned the country, obviously in that case Spain,
yes,
and then the language. Tell us why it was important for you to know something about Spain and the Spanish language in order to play a piece of music.
Well, in my case, I had always, Spanish was my second language ever since high school. And then when I went to a very traditional program at the University of Illinois, the languages that we focused on were German, Italian, and French. And I thought, oh, great, I've prepared myself absolutely incorrectly for my career. But at some point, and I strongly believe this, that the more that we know about music and culture and how these influences affect music and our experiences individually as humans and then with each other because of where we are and our environments and our influences, all these things, that the experience that we get from listening to music is elevated. And so that ties in greatly with education, of course. And so for me, I'd studied the language and then I came across this nationalistic body of music, and it really affected actually my soul. I don't know how to say, but there was something when I heard this national music from Spain, and I'm sure it's in conjunction with the fact that I had studied the language and the country prior to finding this music and being able to express that from the piano, it's like a feeling I can't even describe. And to be able to share that with other people, I just knew this was the path that I needed to take at a very young age. That was like I was a sophomore in college when I sort of discovered
all that. I mean, is there
that.
Any truth to the whole concept that, for example, this very famous pianist, Alicia de la Rocha,
yes.
and she plays this fire piece, Nights in the Gardens of Spain, right?
Yes.
Do you think she has any better insight to that because she's Spanish?
Yes.
Do I understand the music of Vaughan Williams because I'm English better than you because you're not?
Well, you know, I think those cultural influences are there, yes, and I do believe that she was an amazing pianist, Keith, and that she had her own approach to the instrument that other Spanish pianists would have different approaches or different ways of communication. But yes, and I think you have to study the language or the culture more than just superficially. And it's sort of interesting now because technology is such a part of that, and being able to know about a different place in the world is a heck of a lot easier now than it was 20 years ago.
But so, it's absolutely fundamentally important, you think, in order to interpret the music.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And so I, you know, I had gone that route, and I have to tell you, one of the greatest compliments I felt with a review of a CD that was also dedicated to the piano works of Joaquin Rodrigo was a review that said that Dina K. Jones performs as if she were from the country herself. And for me, that was like
that's
acceptance,
wonderful.
You know?
Absolutely.
But it was a lot of years in the making, and of going to Spain and of studying with a particular teacher who could show me these influences of then for me to be able to make my own sort of mark with that,
yeah,
and give it to other people.
What's happened since then? I mean, the university supports research for two reasons. One, as Junius has pointed out, is, you know, to enhance the reputation and build up a junior faculty member with the idea that then we have world-class scientists and musicians, etc. In the case of science, there's always this business of you go and write proposals for big chunks of money, and then there's something called the overhead, you know, 47%, 50% on top of what you've already got that comes directly to the university to help facilitate the running of the university. Now, from your perspective, you don't get the opportunity for money like that, for grants like that.
Right.
How would you articulate that your success has translated to, I'll say, the benefit? I mean, it's a silly question because I understand the answer.
Yes,
but
yes.
The audience, to the benefit of the
yes.
university.
Well, I think it's really been projected in two camps. One is, you know, the commercial audience member, as you mentioned, and for me to be able to offer concerts, not only in El Paso and in this region, but nationally and internationally. It's only grown since that Merkin Hall debut in New York when I first started here as a junior faculty member. And I receive emails with questions about Spanish music or Joaquin Rodrigo in particular. I've made a commercial CD with it's an independent record label called Centaur Records, and that's sold many, many copies now in this period of time. So,
but you're not going to be rich.
Oh, heavens, no. No musician goes into this to be rich, that's for sure.
Well, neither the scientists go into science in general, but never mind. Carry on.
But so there's that whole entertainment purpose that's – I have said it this way, that I feel like I've been able to offer my interpretation to thousands of people.
And the point being, everywhere you are, people will see in the program that you are from the University
yes,
of Texas in
absolutely.
El Paso, and that's where your
part
career
of my
has
biography.
Blossomed.
Yes, yes,
right.
Yes. The other part of it, then, is with the education with the students. And so they have been able to gain these experiences with Spanish music because that's my expertise, and living in El Paso where that language is so part of who they are. And so that is definitely a part of it, even though it's Spain and not Mexico. But the whole idea of the nationalism of culture being ingrained with music, they so understand that here in El Paso. So they love this Spanish repertoire. We had this conference in 2009 where we were able to invite Cecilia Rodrigo, who is the mother of the daughter of the composer. And we also brought in Gregory Allen, who's a piano performance teacher at UT Austin, who has recorded all of the piano works of Joaquin Rodrigo. His work was very important for me when I was studying Rodrigo's pieces. he was really the only American at the time to actually do that.
Well, let me interject there.
Yeah.
When you say you listen to it, so do you have it transcribed on paper also, note by note, and compare? Tell us a little bit about the research aspect of that.
That point was interesting because at that point, getting scores from Spain was not as easy as it is today. Now all of Joaquin Rodrigo's piano works have been published and are very easy to access. But at that point, it was very difficult to get. The time to get the scores was very difficult to get. I went to Spain at some point, was not absolutely sure, and gathered what I could. But Gregory Allen's recordings, that I was just really literally listening to them, some of them with score on CD. This was a CD set. And some of them without score. So it was a lot of just internalizing his ideas. And I had reached out to him to ask him how he perceived Joaquin Rodrigo's music, who was blind. So I had my own concepts about some of these more intricate things. And he was sort of like, well, this was just a recording project for me. I don't really have a lot of insight to that.
I mean, that's a wonderful story. So coming back to you, Junius, I mean, there is an example of university funds, if you like, rather small funds at the beginning, but being a little acorn that's built into a nice little mature oak tree. I mean, and that's what you have in mind, I think. In terms of specifically talking about the arts and
yes, and I think, you know, the arts and humanities are vital intellectual inquiries to having a robust university for students, but also for faculty. So I encourage faculty and staff and others to attend not only student concerts, but recitals, et cetera. But the more we hear from people like Dina or visual artists, to understand sort of the discipline or scientific inquiry approach to performance and interpretation is critical. It's not just a matter of sitting down and deciding you're going to learn the technical pieces of a work and perform it. But there is a whole lot more, as we all know, to the interpretation. Something I know a little bit about, for example, is jazz vocals. So you can hear a jazz standard by three different artists, and the interpretations are often overwhelmingly different.
It's not so simple, I think, in the music of Joaquin Rodrigo. And you've got a score. You're not allowed to be quite so extemporaneous, I presume, Dina.
Well, I listened to him playing his own piano works, and he did some improvisational aspects there, too. And he died before I had a chance to meet him. I know his daughter very well. But when I heard his own interpretations of his pieces a little bit different than what was offered there on the score, I thought, okay,
Oh, that gave you license.
I felt like I could take a little more time here or do the, you know, I think it's maybe more true to us in the classical field than you maybe think.
Or take operatic arias, you know, bound by score, yet very different interpretations, not just technically different by vocal artists, but what they evoke in the listener.
I remember hearing a Tosca, Giuseppe Di Stefano was the soloist, the tenor, and he'd hold on to notes forever in order to get more applause. I mean, it was quite remarkable. I'd like to stay on this note here to get more people listening to Science Studio. We've run out of time. Junius Gonzalez, Provost, University of Texas at El Paso. Dina Jones, Professor of Music, University of Texas at El Paso. Thank you very much both for being here. It's been great fun. And Norma Martinez, as always, in the studio, smiling away. And it'll make it all sound so great when you hear it, so much better than it was in real life. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.